Okay, this is David Banner, author of Loving It All. This is our very last podcast in this series. I may do a podcast on my other book, Frame Shifting, but I don't know yet. As of now, this is the last one. And this is kind of another interesting pivotal chapter in that I've already explained the Enneagram in the second and third chapter. And I've told all of you that if you don't want to get into all the technical aspects of it, you might want to skip chapter 2 and 3. But now I'm going to review the Enneagram for you. And if you want, you can get a review on this chapter. Or if you understand the Enneagram, you can skip this chapter. Okay, the Enneagram is a psychological spiritual tool thousands of years old. The Enneagram of Personality, however, has only been around since the early 1900s. It was brought over to the United States by a Persian mystic named George Gurdjieff, who was an 8, by the way. And Gurdjieff used the Enneagram to define what he calls sleepwalking. And that's actually what it is. When you're in your type, you're unconscious, meaning that you operate habitually as a way of thinking, feeling, and behaving. The beauty of the Enneagram, however, is that you can bust yourself and move right into conscious awareness by noticing consciously your patterns. So that's what I want to help you with in this chapter, is begin to notice what some of these patterns are. Okay, I've already told you that the human mind decided it could judge what is good and what to reject, what to take responsibility for, and what to deny responsibility for. This has been referred to as eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the Bible, which basically is adopting the ego as your operating system. Okay, so this division between what's acceptable and unacceptable is what has created the illusion of separateness. We've already taken this quite as far as we can. If you want to know more about the illusion of separation, besides what I've mentioned in this podcast, I urge you to look at any of Charles Eisenstein's books. A More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible is an excellent book. Also, Sacred Economics is an excellent book, both of which will discuss the illusion of separateness in much greater detail. When this particular state of mind is taken to extremes, where we have it today, folks suffer from depression, despair, and hopelessness. The egoic voice wants you to like some things and dislike others, see some things as good and see some things as bad. In so doing, you get to take 100% responsibility for the stuff you like, but blame others for stuff you don't like. When we adopt a consciousness of separation, we automatically move into conflict and dis-ease. You will never get to a realization of oneness through the counsel of the ego. It is a mental counsel, and the ego is committed to seeing the world as a dangerous, hostile place where its counsel is the only way to the safety and security. Resistance to what is the modus operandi of the ego. But it's possible to cultivate just the opposite, to look with innocence, as a child does, to whatever arises in your field of experience. It's even possible to look at your own emotions from a stance of curiosity and wonder, as you might look at a cloud as it passes through the sky. You simply notice it, marvel at it, appreciate it, and let it pass by. You can do the same thing with your thoughts. Thoughts and feelings are like passing clouds. The ego wants you to grab them and make them significant and reinforce its identity in believing them. Our so-called problems mainly come from believing our thoughts defending our feelings. That's basically why there's so much conflict in the world, is different belief systems. If you don't believe me, check it out. Religious belief systems, political belief systems, you name it, they all produce conflict. This is where meditation is useful. To stop thinking and just let everything be as it is might sound simple, but the mind is always telling you to know more, be more, to do something. All of this endless mind chatter keeps us bound in the egoic perspective. To let go to the mystery of life and stop the incessant automatic thinking, that's why you use meditation. As I mentioned earlier, psychologists have said they estimate a normal egoic human thinks 50,000 thoughts a day. Many of them are routine, many of them are repetitive, many of them are counterproductive, and many of them are negative. The ego believes its identity depends on thinking, and if he lets go of all of them, it will die. Well, the ego is not likely to die because we're still in a physical body, but we can certainly reduce its influence and push it to the background, which is what I advise. You're not going to get rid of it. I mean, even Jesus had an ego, and Moses and Muhammad and Buddha. They all had egos, but they were very, very in the background. And that somebody asked me once, how do you tell the type of an ascended being like Jesus? Well, it's really difficult because they don't have much of an ego. And to know a type is to know ego. There are 9 different versions of ego, and that's what the Enneagram exposes for us, the 9 versions of ego. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, gosh, why only 9? Well, because all the research that's been done on the Enneagram shows that there's only 9 different types. Every country on the planet has people with 9 types of ego. Some countries, the type is more dominant. For example, the United States. You could call it a type 3 country because the culture emphasizes success, achievement, and performance, characteristics of the type 3. Okay, Brazil, for example, some people have said it's a type 7 culture because they emphasize fun and joy. You could go on and on. Japan, some people say it's a type 4 culture because they're very into beauty and uniqueness. So let's go forth a little bit with this particular orientation. The Enneagram is a map of these 9 ego distortions. What you want to do is to understand which distortion is the one that rules you. One of my teachers in the narrative tradition told me this: we visit all 9 types. And that's true. I've experienced myself as a 4, as a 3, as an 8. But my home base is the 7, and that's what you want to get to. You want to get to what your home base is, the one where you hang out the most and the one that gives you the most trouble, okay? So that's what you want to discover. Back in chapters 2 and 3, I gave you a process for developing an understanding of your type. And if you're still confused, please give me a call, 608-637-2451, and I'll run you through about a 15 or 20 minute interview to identify your type. Again, the key thing to remember about the Enneagram types: you cannot depend on the behavior to identify a type. You have to get to the underlying need, or the underlying passion of the type. Okay, so all types, several types can look alike. For example, the 3, the 7, the 8, and the 1. They all work hard, but their underlying motivation is quite different. The one is motivated to get things done perfectly. The three is motivated just to get them done to move on to the next thing. The seven is motivated for fun. Sevens only want to do things that are fun. And the eights are motivated by lust. You know, bigger, better, etc. Okay? So mastery arises from innocence. What do I mean by that? I mean that once you understand your type, you can begin to bust yourself when you notice you are habitually thinking, feeling, and acting in a certain way in a situation. You can start noticing this, and when you do, then you can choose another behavior consciously. For example, as a type 7, I get bored easily. So halfway through writing a book, and this book was no exception, I get bored and think, oh, I got to go do something else. Well, you bust yourself and say, no, you're a type 7, David. You finish the damn book. So I do. I've written 6 books now, and I always wanted to quit every one of them. So get used to it. Your type will have particular things you get stuck on, and you just have to move through them. Mastery comes from innocence. I mean, just like a small child. A small child doesn't judge. A small child accepts whatever happens. And that's what you want. Jesus said, we must become as little children, Matthew 18:3, to enter the kingdom of heaven. That's what he was talking about. The way to oneness is to consciously cultivate the attitude of wonder and openness, just like a little child. Now, you might think this sounds naive. What about all those evil people out in the world who will want to hurt you? If there are people out there who want to hurt you, that means that there's more work to do in your consciousness to integrate those shadow elements which have created these people in your lives. So, again, this is not blaming the victim. This is just helping you understand that everything you outpicture out there is contained in your consciousness. There are no accidents. Stuff doesn't happen to you accidentally. So what you want to do is begin to use the Enneagram to develop compassion and empathy. Okay, why? Because if you're one with everything, then each fixation is contained in you. Begin to recognize that the other person is just doing their type. It's not personal. They're not trying to irritate you or hurt you. They are just acting habitually as the type would dictate. You react to it because it's not what you want them to do. And this type is contained in you. It looks like the other person, but as you develop more and more awareness, you will feel yourself acting in all these ways. The more you experience yourself acting as an Enneagram type, the more clearly you will see that none of it is personal. I think I told you the story of my beloved wife who used to watch me do the dishes. She's a 9 with a 1 wing, which means she has a very strong perfectionist streak. Remember, the wing modifies the type. So she wanted me to do them perfectly. Well, I'm a 7, and I'm not too interested in perfection. As a matter of fact, I can be kind of casual when I'm washing the dishes. Well, that would drive her nuts. So, how can I develop compassion and empathy? Well, take, for example, the type 1, the perfectionist. These people are very, very responsible. They have what's called a perfectionist fixation. So, I mentioned this before in chapters 2 and 3, but let me mention it again. A fixation is when you move from wanting to get it right to having to get it right. That's when it becomes a fixation. A fixation is like a compulsion or addiction. Ones are naturally drawn to what's wrong in their environment. So if you're a 1, you will notice when you walk in the room the stain on the rug, the wall that wasn't painted correctly, the person's wearing clothes that have a tear in them, you know, whatever it is. So this is what this particular type notices: error. To overcome this fixation, you can begin to cultivate a sense that this is good enough. You can begin to consciously cut yourself some slack. Now, the ego will not like this, since it's looking to resist. So your mind will argue, oh, well, it's not done well enough yet. So what you do to your mind is you say, thank you for sharing, but I want to see the world with innocent eyes. If you're not a type one, you can begin to develop an empathy toward that persona and how hard they are on themselves and usually on other people. The one is part of the anger triad of the Enneagram. Eights, nines, and ones are all anger types. And what means they all three express anger as their motivation. Eights get really mad, yell and scream, and then they're fine. Nines hold back on their anger because they don't like conflict. So they'll hold anger in, and finally they'll explode with it. But it takes a while. My wife will do that every once in a while. She'll just explode with anger. But it's not very usual for a nine. And the ones, again, because it's not good or right to be angry, it'll come out in them as resentment. And what they resent is people who aren't trying as hard as they are to be good. Okay, you've got a kick out of this. The type two is the helper or the giver. Twos are like chameleons. They adapt to whoever needs their help, and they're quite good at it. The two, three, and four are the image triad of the Enneagram. They're called the feeling or heart types. They make their decisions with their emotions. All three of these types have adopted an image to receive appreciation and, they hope, love from other people. If you're a type two, you can begin to cultivate a sense of I have needs too. It's very hard for a two because they don't want to admit they have any needs. They want to just focus on your needs. But if you can get them to, over time, to begin to say, well, maybe I do have needs. This is a spiritual step towards humility. And that's the task for the two, humility. Type three is the achiever or the performer. Okay, these types are into efficiency and performance. These are very successful people. As a matter of fact, success is their fixation. These are the doers of the Enneagram. They get rewarded for getting things done. If they don't get things done, they tend to reframe it as a learning experience. Threes are people who have no space in their daytimers. The passion of the three is called deceit. And what that means is they deceive themselves by thinking that they are their goal accomplishments and their success. And they deceive others the same way. So therefore, the spiritual path for the three is honesty. The four is the tragic romantic. These are people who are very unique and very artistic. They tend to long for what they think is missing in their lives. They experience melancholy and sometimes depression as they feel others don't understand them. The passion of the four is envy. Fours tend to see others as having what they themselves do not have. It's not the same as jealousy. They don't want to take it from you. They just wish they had it too, whatever it is. These are people who get attention by being unique in their expression. They are meaning junkies. You will never see them wearing polyester, for example. Low self-esteem is especially a problem for fours. They tend to be hard on themselves. The five is called the observer. It's the first of the mental types. Five, six, seven are all mental types. And these are fear types. And the five is afraid. And how they deal with their fear is they tend to withdraw. Fives want to know everything they can so they can be an expert. And usually that is their defense, is knowing everything. So fives feel safe when they draw on the power and the energy of type eight. When I was talking about wings and arrows, go back to the chapters 2 and 3 and you can notice that conversation. Also, just look at your Enneagram diagram and you can see how they're connected. Fives are usually introverted people, their passion is avarice. They tend to want to hide their stuff, especially their knowledge. They start out wanting to know everything. They fixate on having to know everything. Spiritual path for the five is non-attachment. That means they need to loosen their grip on what they know and let it flow to others freely. Type six, the loyal skeptic, the core fear type, they want to prepare for any eventuality beforehand. Their motto is be prepared. The chief passion of the six archetype is doubt. Sixes often have a hard time getting typed because they doubt it. They doubt that they're a six. Okay, there's two versions of the six, the phobic and the counterphobic. The phobic six is just afraid, and they want to anticipate anything bad that might happen. The counterphobic, on the other hand, tends to move toward danger as a way with coping with their fear. They tend to look brave, but they're just as afraid as the phobic six. Gordon Liddy of Watergate fame was probably a counterphobic six. In his autobiography, he brags about dealing with his fear of rodents by catching a rat, cooking, and eating part of it. He then said, "Rats are now afraid of me." The passion of the six is fear, and the spiritual path is courage. Then there's the seven, my type, the last of the fear types. Sevens don't look like they're afraid at all. They're optimistic, creative, ready for adventure, spontaneous. They're fun junkies. The God essence of the seven is joy. God is joyful. But the passion is gluttony. What this means is they're a gluttony for experience, usually, although it can be a gluttony for food. It tends to be for experience. They want to try everything. That's why they're called epicures. Immature sevens can be quite superficial and dance around problems. And Robert Preston in The Music Man is a caricature of the seven. Come into town, get everybody organized, put on a show, and leave town as quickly as possible. Fours are afraid of two things, boredom and pain. Type eight, the boss, the perfecter. The God essence of the eight is power. Eights are part of the anger triad I mentioned earlier. The passion of the eight is lust. They want more of everything. Self-preservation eights want more things. Social eights want more contacts with important people. And sexual eights want to conquest in a sexual manner with their partner. They're lustful people. Their orientation is powerful. But when they get comfortable, they can be remarkable, caring, and giving people. And then the last one, of course, is type nine, the mediator or the peacemaker. Type nine has a God essence of peace. God is peaceful. The passion for the nine is called sloth or laziness. This is an anger type, but they rarely let themselves get angry, primarily because they hate conflict, as I mentioned earlier. They're often procrastinators, and they're late to meetings and other appointments. They're typically not initiators or entrepreneurs. They make good followers rather than leaders. The spiritual path for the nine is called right action. They typically don't know what they want. They're good at knowing what other people want, but they don't know what they want. Okay, so that oneness will dawn when each of us can watch ourselves as the observer of our thoughts, attitudes, and behaviors. The quickest way to oneness is to love it all. The egoic tendency is to accept responsibility for what you like and to blame others for what you don't like. The fact is, you created it all with your mind, and the only sane thing to do is accept responsibility for it all. So, there you go. That is loving it all, living from an awakening heart. ¶¶